King Saul started out a very honorable king, very humble, but he became arrogant. He began to offer sacrifices and participate in practices that God had not authorized him to do. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, we read about him offering the sacrifice prior to going to battle with the Philistines, and how that was displeasing to God. Samuel said, wait till the appointed time, and he didn't wait for Samuel to come. We note in 1 Samuel chapter 15 that King Saul was instructed to smite Amalek and destroy the Amalekites, but instead he brought back King Agag, the best of the Amalekites, and brought back those animals preparing to sacrifice them unto the Lord. And Samuel rebuked him and pointed out that what he did was as the sin of witchcraft and idolatry. Saul was rejected then as being king. From that point forward, we see that Saul of Tarsus became the Apostle Paul. That's not this man. All right, this is King Saul, son of Kish, king of Israel. Now, when I do that again, you correct me. Don't let me by with that. I know better. But we note that King Saul continued to plummet, and eventually he went to the witch of Endor to offer unto her a request to bring up Samuel. Now, what was the problem with him going to the witch of Endor? Well, witchcraft was sinful, and Saul had ordered that those who practice witchcraft, that they be killed. And he's found this woman, and his desire is that she would bring up Samuel. And of course, when Samuel appears, I think she's as much surprised as anybody else. But nonetheless, she accuses Saul of betraying her, and Saul tells her to be not afraid, and so forth and so on. But his desire of Samuel is what's going to incur in the battle with the Philistines. And what does Samuel tell him? This is chapter 28. Tomorrow, you'll be dead tomorrow. Now, in the process of all of this, what's the relationship between Saul and David? All right, Saul's trying to kill David. And David, as we have studied, has been fleeing from place to place, beginning in Ramah and then Nob, and we'll look at some of those places on the map in just a moment as you review those places. And now we find that Saul is about to die. Where's David? He's with the Philistines. That's right. And he has a relationship with Achish, the king of Gath. The king of Gath, and we talked about that as these are city-states. There were other kings among the Philistines. And we noted that David is with Achish, and Achish has given him a city, and the city is Ziklag. And the relationship between Achish and David seems to be very good. At least Achish thinks so. And when when David is away from Ziklag, he's going down into what he tells Achish, the southern cities or areas, rather, south of Judah, south in Judah, fighting against the inhabitants of Israel. And in fact, that's not who he's fighting against. Who's he fighting against? He's fighting against the allies of the Philistines. That's right. And he kills them all. So there's no report that comes back to Achish regarding what he is doing. But when David in chapter 29 is preparing to go with Achish to fight against Israel. Now keep in mind that this battle is about to take place between the Philistines and the Israelites here in Mount Gilboa, David is going up with Achish, the king of Gath, to engage in this battle. And what do the other kings of the Philistines say to Achish about David? I don't trust him.
They don't want David to be involved in this battle because they're afraid that his loyalty is with the Israelites instead of with the Philistines. Does Achish assure them of David's loyalty? Yes, he does, but they're still not convinced. And so where does David go?
Who knows how that might have turned out if they had not sent David home. That might have proven to be to their own demise. Indeed. But David returns to Ziklag, and when he gets there, what does he find? This is chapter 30. Somebody's been to visit.
He's been destroyed by the Amalekites, and everybody's gone.
All right, that's interesting to me. The city's been destroyed by the Amalekites, and everybody's gone, including David's wives. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But wasn't Saul supposed to destroy the Amalekites back over there in chapter 15? And now here they rise to the surface again, and we've got problems with the Amalekites. And David later has problems with the Amalekites. But we note in this chapter, in chapter 30, that David returns to Ziklag, and this is what he finds. The Amalekites have come, and they've burned the city of Ziklag, and they've taken the inhabitants away, including David's wives. David calls for Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, the priest, to bring the ephod to inquire of the Lord. Now, I want you to note that this was a practice of David, to inquire of the Lord what he should do. And what does the Lord tell him to do with the Amalekites? Pursue them. Destroy them. That's right. Pursue them. So he does. And in verse 16 beginning, we know that when he brought him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the ground, eating and drinking and dancing because of all the great spoil that they had taken out of the land of the Philistines and out of the land of Judah. Now, the Amalekites think that they've really gained a great victory and that they've destroyed Ziklag and taken portions of Judah. But this young Egyptian has been left behind by the Amalekites, and David and his army. They find this young Egyptian. Why isn't he taken along with them? He was sick, so he's left behind. And the question really to him is, where are they? And he makes an arrangement that he will reveal the whereabouts of the Philistines. And so David goes down and smites the Philistines from twilight even until the evening of the next day, verse 17 tells us. And there escaped not a man of them, save 400 young men who rode upon camels and fled. What did David do with the spoil of the Philistines? I'm sorry, the spoil of the Amalekites.
Brought it back.
He brings his wives and all the people back. He brings the spoil back. And we know that there were some among David's army that did not go to fight with the Amalekites. They're left behind. And in fact, David's army, it has been mentioned, was primarily made up of a bunch of hoodlums. And their thoughts about their fellow soldiers wasn't all that good. Here are some who stayed behind. They've not engaged in battle with the Amalekites. So what's their idea we should do with the spoil?
We get to keep
all right, we get to keep what otherwise would have been theirs. And how does David settle that argument?
It's not
going to be that way. What are we going to do with the spoil? We'll divide it fairly. That's right. We'll divide it among everybody. Now, when you get to verse 26 of this chapter, chapter 30, verse 26, there the text tells us, and when David came to Ziklag, he sent of the spoil unto the elders of Judah, even to his friends, saying, behold, the present for you of the spoil of the enemies of Jehovah. And you read down through the remainder of this chapter, and you see that division of the spoil was equal among all of those who had identified themselves with his army. Now, when you come to the 30th chapter, the 31st chapter, the 31st chapter, I'm going to just leave that map there for a moment. We're going to talk about it a little bit. It says in verse 1, now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled from before the Philistines, and fell down slain in Mount Gibeah. And the Philistines followed hard upon Saul and upon his sons. And the Philistines slew Jonathan, and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle went sore against Saul, and the archers overtook him, and he was greatly distressed by reason of the archers. Then said Saul to his armor bearer, "Draw thy sword and thrust me through therewith, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and abuse me." And his armor bearer would not, for he was sore afraid. Therefore Saul took his sword and fell upon it, and when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he likewise fell upon his sword and died with him. So Saul died, and his three sons, and his armor bearer, and all his men that same day together. Well, that's exactly what Samuel had said would occur. He and his sons all died that same day. What happens to Saul's army? Keep in mind the significant numbers of the Philistines.
Which are right.
All right, they're running. You'll look at verse 7. It tells us that the Philistines came and dwelt in their cities. So the Israelites flee from their cities, and they go over into the Transjordan area. And, of course, the Philistines then just inhabit this portion that you see on the map. Now, on our map, I want you to notice it as identified. I forget what page number this is in your lesson book, but this map is from your lesson book to identify the days of Israel during the days of King Saul. And Israel is to be identified with this yellow portion of the map. Now, you remember when God made promise of the land unto Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12, we see the borders of that land defined in Genesis chapter 15. What were the borders of the land of Israel? The promised land.
The Brook of Egypt to the Great River.
All right, which was up here, the River Euphrates. Now, notice that this constitutes the kings of Zobah. We'll have occasion eventually to talk about that during the days of David and about 2 Samuel, I believe it's about chapter 5 or so, and we'll discuss that. But notice how that the empire of David has been greatly, I'm sorry, of Saul has been greatly reduced. Do you see that on this map? The Philistines, the Amalekites, all of these round about have made encroachments upon the land of Israel to the point that it is diminished significantly in size. When you study from Genesis chapter 15, we see that the inhabitants of the land are described as reaching from the river Euphrates to the river of Egypt, even to the Mediterranean Sea, the Great Sea, to be the land that was to belong unto the children of Israel. Yes?
Just a kind of side question. It looks like the Amalekites would have had to go through, you know, part of the land against Ziklag that was inhabited by other people.
Yes.
Do you think it was in retaliation for what they did to the Amalekites with those two cities that they destroyed utterly or something? Because it doesn't look like that would be my first choice to go attack. But it looks like they made a point of going specifically to that area and taking care of it.
Well, keep in mind, this is where David lived. And David has made numerous trips down here to fight against these Amalekites and others along this border of the southern portion. So it would be a natural speculation, I'll call it that because we don't know for sure, but it would be a natural assumption to assume that this would be in retaliation because David is gone. He's up here. And when he comes back, this is what he finds. But keep in mind that Ziklag is among the Philistines, and these spoils now are not only from Ziklag, but also from the Philistines. We don't find that these are the very best of friends, though they might, in some respects, be allies, because they have a common enemy. But to describe them as the best of friends, certainly that would not be the case. So yes, in answer to your question, likely so.
Do we have any idea of the how the borders of the kingdom changed between the time that Saul started and the time that Saul ended, or do we think most of this encroachment happened during the period of the judges?
Well, during the period of the judges, we have deliverers that would get some back. So, that's the problem. See, we've got this exchange going back and forth and back and forth. And when you consider the period of the judges, just a little over 300 years, 15 judges. And we're not looking at the judges necessarily in sequence. Something could be happening up here and down here at the same time. So they may be losing portions here and then regaining, losing portions here and regaining, losing portions in various directions and regaining periodically on and off over this period of 300 plus years. So to give a breakdown of when what was lost and when what was gained back, no, I couldn't do that. I don't think it's revealed to us in the Scriptures. And of course, then we've got the 40-year reign of King Saul, expanding the entirety of it. But one of the things that we do want to note is that when David comes along, he recovered his dominion as he fought against the king of Zobah up here. Which tells us that this portion, though lost, David gets that back. So during the days of David, he's expanding. And, of course, during the days of David and then Solomon, it's at its biggest that it ever was. Okay? So if that answers your question. I don't know if we can answer that.
That is what,
page 86. Page 86, okay. Right in there, folks. In your lesson book. That's an interesting question, though. That would be interesting to see that displayed on a map that you could maneuver and show the years when such and such was lost and then as it was regained. Yeah. Why don't you work on that, Richard? Put together as a PowerPoint.
Yeah. Moving map display.
Moving map display. Yeah.
Okay.
I'd like
that. I was just going to say that as we look through the period of the Judges, we can see that the incursions were made by the Philistines, the Canaanites, the Phoenicians, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Amalekites, the Edomites, all of these people.
All around.
All of them were making incursions into the land. And we see that they were finally given relief from that. But yeah, like you say, there's no indication whether the land was taken back or not. I don't think we're ever rid of the Philistines again.
No.
No. The Canaanites are not mentioned a whole lot, but the Phoenicians are mentioned from time to time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think they've ever pushed back to the great city.
Well, one of the great problems was when they came in and first possessed the land, though they possessed the land, they didn't drive out all the inhabitants. They were not to make covenants and so forth, as we have studied in Deuteronomy chapter 7, and they did. They did make such covenants, and that proved to be to their detriment. I saw another hand. Yes, Randy?
Can you put your red dot on Mount Gilboa?
Mount Gilboa, right here.
Israel.
Yeah, right here. Does that help? Alright, red dot's right up here in the top left hand corner. Alright. Right there.
And then the Jabesh Gilead.
Over here to the east. On the Trans-Jordan side. Mahanaim. Is another, while we have that map up, going to be another important place during the reign of David. We want to know where that is just now. Okay? Any other questions or comments while we're stopped?
This last battle that Saul is fighting in, that's
right here.
You're talking about?
Yeah, right here.
So that's where they're coming in. When they're fighting the Philistines?
Philistines, yes. Yes, the Philistines have made an invasion up through the Canaanite area. And when you look at the topographical map, you'll see why. We've got travel paths up this way, and then they came in like so into the area of Mount Gilboa. Okay, this would be the way of the sea, I think. This is the way of Shur coming up this way. And then on the Trans-Jordan side, this was the King's Highway. Came up this plateau. Okay? Now, very quick little review while I have this map before us. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, we've got this area where the fight took place with Goliath's suck-up. You'll see that on the map. And then David begins to flee from King Saul to Ramah. Here's where Ramah is, 1 Samuel 19. And then follow that to Nob. You'll see that David is not moving very far, but nonetheless he is in flight from Saul. And 1 Samuel chapter 21. And then he goes to Achish, king of Gath, where in 1 Samuel 22, how is his behavior described?
As a madman.
As a madman, yes. And then he flees from Achish and goes to the cave of Adullam. You'll see that on the map here. And then he takes his family to Moab, where he thinks they will be safe, and he comes back to the forest of Ereth. And then while he's in the forest of Ereth, Keilah is attacked by the Philistines, and David then comes to their defense and runs off the Philistines. And then Saul learns of what has taken place and comes to find David. And Saul's inquiry of the Lord is, will the inhabitants of Keilah be faithful to me or to Saul? And what did God say? Well, Saul, they'll betray you. And so he flees from Keilah and goes and hides in the wilderness of Ziph, and then to the caves of the cave in Engedi. And while he is in Ziph, we basically have the same concern whether or not the Ziphites will be faithful to him or they will betray him. And what would they do? They would betray him. And so he hides then in Engedi, where he spares Saul's life. And I believe, Julie, this is what you were telling us about, I think, last time, about how that in Engedi, what did David do to Saul?
It's where he was in the cave, and Saul came in to relieve himself, and he cut his, the bottom of his cloak, his robe.
All right, he cut his robe or coat. And then David flees back over to... Why didn't he just kill him, by the way? God's anointing. Very good. David flees again to the king of Achish. And this is where it seems that David makes a covenant with Achish. They get along, it seems, quite well. And Achish then gives unto David the city of Ziklag, right here. And this... I want to make that clear. Can you follow those arrows? I've got a whole lot on the screen.
Yes.
Down here in the southern part of Judah, this is where we read that David is raiding the Geshurites and the Gerzites and the Amalekites down here on the southern border of Judah, what we commonly think of as Judah. At this point, it was still united, so we'll call it Israel, but the southern tribe of Judah down here. And in fact, he is raiding against those who would be allies of the Philistines, but he tells the king of Gath, Achish, that he's fighting against those who would be in the southern portion of Israel. And he kills all of them, of course, of the enemies of God's people, so there's no word getting back to Achish, the king of Gath. Now, the places on this map, do they all sound familiar? Yep. The events that occur there, does it all sound familiar? So this is a good review. You know what's taking place on this map. David then returns to Ziklag, where he finds that the Amalekites have been while he was away. And then he has to go down and fight against the Amalekites and bring his family back to Ziklag. All right. Now, chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. Chapter 31, verse 1 Samuel. We've talked about Saul's death. We've talked about how that the Philistines, because of the fierceness of their archers, Saul is wounded and he kills himself. Oh, and by the way, this was a map that I was looking for. One, this shows the path of the Philistines, or the supposed path. Here's the way of the sea. And you see the travel routes that would bring their army right on Mount Gilboa. To fight against Saul. So they go through the Canaanite area and then turn down through the plain of Jezreel, which we do want to remember becomes a very prominent battleground area throughout the history of Israel. And this is where, of course, Megiddo is located. So when you read about our Megiddon and such things, you understand the significance of that term. Is identified with numerous battles throughout Old Testament history. All right? So in 1 Samuel chapter 31, the Israelites meet with the Philistines here in Mount Gilboa. Things go south in a hurry. Saul's three sons are killed. Saul kills himself. Saul's army flees, and the Philistines inhabit the area of Mount Gilboa and the Israelite cities in this portion of northern Israel. Now, Saul and his sons, their bodies are taken to Bethshan and nailed to the wall of the city. Now, why was that done?
That's a display of victory.
Display of victory, yes. Well, we might look at that and say that this was one of the things that Paul saw, that Saul was concerned about. I can't even say Paul of Tarsus. Tarsus. Moving right along, chapter 31. Chapter 31. If you'll note in verse 8, it came to pass on the morrow when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen in Mount Gilboa. And they cut off his head and stripped off his armor and sent it into the land of the Philistines round about to carry the tidings into the house of their idols and to the people. And they put his armor in the house of the Ashereth, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth-shan. And when the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead heard concerning him that which the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose and went all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth-shan, and they came to Jabesh and burnt them there, and they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. Now, in verse 11, when you read this concerning the inhabitants of Jabesh-Gilead that go and get the body of King Saul and his sons and bury them, why do they do that? All right, Jenny?
They're honoring the king.
They're honoring the king, yes, but why? What debt do they owe the king? All right, well, they did, yes. Go back, if you will, to chapter 11.
They, the ones that the Ammonites tried to say, put out your right eye.
Yeah, look at that, back over there in chapter 11. Chapter 11, beginning at verse 1. It says, "And Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, make a covenant with us, and we will serve thee. And Nahash the Ammonite said unto them, on this condition will I make it with you, that all your right eyes be put out, and I will lay it for a reproach upon all Israel." Now when Saul heard about this, what did he do? He cut up his oxen and sent it out through Israel and said, "This is what I'm going to do to your oxen if you don't come and help me defend these good folks." And so he had an army. Where was Saul when he learned of all of this? Out in the field, following the oxen. As it were, plowing, we might think of that. Cultivating the crops or whatever you do when you follow oxen around in the field. So he came to their rescue. And the men of Jabesh-Gilead didn't forget that. When Saul was finally killed, they went and got his body and honored his body by burying him in the land of Israel. Any questions or comments just here? All right. Well, that ends, of course, the life of Saul, but it doesn't end the affairs of Israel. Israel's in distress. They're fleeing. The Philistines are inhabiting their cities, and this is not good for the land of Israel. Once again, you see how that the Israelite territory is so diminished from what it was during the beginning days of its existence. Yes, Terry?
This 31st chapter, the story about the demise of Saul and his sons, that ends the the dynasty or the lineage. Saul, and it makes one think back about Jacob in the 49th chapter of Genesis.
All right.
In verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah.
That's right. That's right. So this lineage was going to come from Judah. At the time, we've got now the first king a Benjamite. And so God would have, and of course that raises, as we've discussed, some interesting questions. God said, I would have established through Samuel. I would have established your kingdom. But because you've done this, it'll be taken from you. Now, we know that Saul was told that. Saul very well knew that, and he later expressed that to David, that he knew that he was going to be the next king. And so that's the working of that. But the territory is greatly reduced, and when it's established with the lineage of David becoming king, there's a lot of territory to take back, and David does do that. Okay. John, what are those? We've already looked at that. All right. Now, I want to look at King Saul one more time here as we look at just a synopsis of his life. Saul began very humble. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, 10, 11, and so forth, we see him appearing to be a very humble man. 1 Samuel chapter 9, reading in verse 21, when the king was to be appointed, as the people had asked for a king. In verse 21, Saul said, am not I a Benjamite of the smallest of the tribes of Israel, and my family the least of all the families of the tribe of Benjamin? Wherefore then speakest thou to me after this manner? He didn't consider himself worthy to be even considered as being a king. And then in the 10th chapter, in verse 21, chapter 10, verse 21, once again, he brought the tribe of Benjamin near by their families, and the family of the Machirites was taken. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken, but when they sought him, he could not be found. We found that he had hidden himself among the baggage. But then in 1 Samuel chapter 15, what's happening? Chapter 13 and chapter 15, what's happening? He's turning against God. Chapter 13 is where we want to remember of Saul being told by Samuel, you wait till the appointed time and I'll offer the sacrifice. And Saul said, no, I can't do that. I've got, well, when the appointed time came and Samuel wasn't there, Saul became impatient and frightened because of the number of the Philistines, and his army was deserting. And so he said, I forced myself, and he offered the sacrifice. And then in the 15th chapter, we noted that he brought back the best of the Amalekites and did not destroy them as God had instructed him. Now in verse 23, it tells us, for rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as idolatry and terephim. Because thou hast rejected the word of Jehovah, he also, or hath also rejected thee from being king. Now it's interesting that Saul started out very humble and he ended up in rebellion to God. Now look at the end as we further describe it. Stubborn, rebellious. When he's approached about the sin that he's committed, rather than to just acknowledge the sin, he begins to make excuses for what he's done and began then to blame the people. What was it Samuel said that you did? You've behaved very foolish. Sin always is. It's the result of a foolish, selfish decision. And that's what Saul did. And furthermore, his kingdom was taken from him. We just mentioned that. The kingdom could have been established in his dynasty, but it was to be removed. That's right.
Motivation.
Well, if you could come up with a reason for it, you might try to justify it.
Yeah.
But it's not justifiable. It's selfish. And so you could just bounce that off of this word. It's rebellion. It's genuinely random.
This is just a really random thought, but of Saul's rule, the one sin that he seems to have come down really hard on is witchcraft. And he was told his rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft.
Excellent.
That's the only thing that they really show him standing up against. So I thought it was strange, the connection there.
That is interesting. I've not and then Daryl.
I just wanted, it's always worth reading verse 22 as well as 23.
All right.
Up there, but, what Samuel's whole message was in Samuel, 1 Samuel 15:22, Samuel said, "As the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams." So even his excuse was blown out of the water.
Yeah.
Because he said, "Well, we're just going to sacrifice some of these animals now because God said destroy them."
Yeah. That's rebellion.
Yeah, so that's why he continues. But it just, it's always worth pointing out to obey is better than sacrifice. Because even if you think, well, I'm going to be sacrificing this, or whether it's a burnt offering like that, or whether it's a sacrifice that we come up with, that I'm going to do this for the Lord. If the Lord didn't ask you to do something, you should do what he says, not what you think.
That's right. That's the bottom line. So he lost his kingdom. He lost his peace of mind. We know that. Yes, David. I'm sorry, Daryl. Get right to you. Let me get Daryl and I'll come right back to you. Right.
Well, I was wondering about that word, terrible. I hadn't noticed that before.
Idol. It was an idol.
An idol.
Uh-huh.
What is that related to the seraphim?
Terrible
seraphim.
No, I don't think so. You got me a definition there on your computer with
terrible.
Oh,
I have it now.
The I am ending is plural.
Pardon me?
The I am ending is just the plural.
Okay.
It says that the American Standard translates it terrible. King James uses idol, idolatry.
Yeah.
And so he's saying that this is the same as idolatry.
Yeah.
Witchcraft and idolatry is essentially the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I wouldn't, I knew the meaning of it, but I just wondered because the root, it's except the S and the T. Just wondering what the root of that one is, the E-R, A-P-H-I-M.
I can't tell you that.
Because they all, they mean the same thing. The first letter changes, so it would be interesting to know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an area of, I just haven't explored. But he lost his peace of mind. An evil spirit was sent to the Lord. He was troubled. And he lost his best friend, which, by the way, was David. David had played music to comfort him, and David was his, in many respects, his servant. And he lost that. And he lost his fellowship with God as God rejected him for his disobedience. He lost his life, and as far as any record is concerned, he lost his soul. Okay? Any comments or questions? Yes?
You also see, like, in almost in the very end, he sees the soothsayer and asks us to bring up.
He's desperate, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's desperate. David, I'm sorry, I'll get my deficit wrong.
No, he lost big time, but what also was amazing, listen, his best friend, David, could have killed him at least twice and didn't do it because he recognized. That God put him in his scheme. And so David respected that. And then even when the messenger came with news of Saul, then I believe that messenger was slain. But he recognized that if anyone takes away the king or those of power, it would be God that does it. Not by his hand or whatever else.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, Richard and then Randy. Yeah, hey, you.
And back at the commentary on 15:23 about this, and the commentator that I've got says the King James has iniquity and idolatry, whereas the ASV has idolatry and terrorism. And then it talks about the word iniquity in the King James or idolatry in the ASV. And then it goes on to talk about the word translated idolatry in the King James or teraphim in the ASV. This teraphim, a masculine plural noun, a kind of penates or household gods, reflecting the original word the ASV translates teraphim. Nothing is ever said about Saul's participating in idolatry. It is therefore likely that he opposed idolatry as well as witchcraft. But Samuel's point is that Saul's disobedience to God, when he told him to do something, was just as bad as Saul thought witchcraft and idolatry were.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not consistent.
We do that often, though. We're not consistent.
Randy?
Right along the same lines, Carol just found over in Genesis 31, verse 19, when Laban had gone to shear his flock, and Rachel stole the household idols that were her father's. And there's a marginal reference that says Hebrew was terrified.
Yeah.
Household idols.
Yeah.
Jenny? On that same subject, it looks like either Saul or David or Michael had a terrapin. So when David came to Michael and said, "Let me out, your dad's trying to kill me," she put the terrapin in the bed to pretend that it was David so that they would think somebody was still there. So that kind of confuses me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I noticed that when I was reading. I've forgotten that, but I did notice that. The thing that struck me was the likely size of it to imitate a man.
which makes it seem like that was a much larger terrapin than the one that Rachel took.
Yeah. Had it under camel.
So interesting when you think about it. If you look at this thing and you take it as your God, and now here you are stuck in your bed to pretend it's your God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as I sometimes say to Richard, don't get me started on food, it's just an idolatry. You can read some about that in Isaiah 44, again in Psalms 115. All right. I want you to notice carefully on your lesson book the material that you're asked to read. And the lesson book, as it describes in lesson number 23, David, a man after God's own heart. You'll know that the book of 2 Samuel is about the reign of David. 2 Samuel. Okay? So I want you to begin reading this portion of text. Now, one of the things that I've said we're going to be doing from time to time is when we get to this segment of the study, you'll notice that the Chronicles are introduced. When you're reading in 1 and 2, in 2nd. King, second Samuel on into 1 Kings and then 2 Kings as we discuss this period of the remaining portion of the United Kingdom, the reign of David and the reign of his son Solomon. And then as we discuss the period of the divided kingdom, the kings of Israel and the kings of Judah, we're going to be finding parallel information in the book of Kings, or books of Kings, and Chronicles. Okay? So there's going to be much information that will glean from one, and then, like studying the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, to find additional information about the same thing. So be sure you read the material that is identified in your lesson book to be prepared for our studies from class to class. Yes?
Well,
I think this is one of the earlier combined books that got divided.
Yeah, when that gets into a study of the subject of biblical criticism, and why when you begin to study translations, some of the earlier ones don't have a first and second this or that. It's all one book. And when you count the names of the books of the Bible, some say, well, you see here, well, this is how it's explained. Some of these divisions occurred later, so we've got more books than once there were. Randy?
My memory's not perfect, but if I remember right, 1st and 2nd Samuel were at first called 1st and 2nd Kings, and 1st and 2nd Kings were 3rd and 4th Kings. Those were the books of the Kings.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know that I knew that. One of the things that, in answering your question, Jenny, you might note is Peter's statements in Acts chapter 3, beginning in verse 22, when he said, "All the prophets from Samuel on." Well, when you consider the order of books at the time that Peter made that statement, it's helpful to consider that in reference to your question, the bulk of material that we have from Samuel. Okay, but it's an interesting question because you've got Samuel writing at a time about things that were down the pipe. That's interesting, isn't it? Okay, anyone else? All right. Well, having said that, I want to call your attention to the date on this chart. 1,000. When we study about David, we know that David ruled how long?
40 years.
40 years. But in reference to Christ, we use the figure 1,000, that he lived 1,000 years before Jesus. And that becomes quite significant when we look at the things that David says about the coming of Jesus. Okay? Many of the prophecies were written by David in the Psalms in particular regarding the coming of the Messiah 1,000 years before he came. And the reason why we want to date this is we don't have to depend solely upon biblical history to know the history of some of these kings. We can look at history outside the Bible and know that a man named David lived, and he was king of Israel, and we can know about when he lived. So that assigns a date to the things that we're going to be talking about, the significance of David's prophecies. Now, having said all that, we've noted that David is described as a man after God's own heart. Well, we know that that was the kind of man that Samuel told Saul that God wanted to be king, a man after God's own heart. The Apostle Paul, and I get to say that, in Acts chapter 13, as he's preaching in the synagogue in Antioch of, not Syria, the other one,
Pisidia,
thank you, Antioch of Pisidia, makes mention of David in chapter 13, verse 22, as a man after God's own heart, man after my heart, who shall do all my will. And the significance of that in this setting is, in verse 23, it says, of this man's seed hath God, according to promise, brought unto Israel a Savior. Now that takes you back to 2 Samuel chapter 7, and we're going to talk about that, the prophecy that was made concerning the lineage of David, the establishment of the kingdom of David, and so forth. Now when we talk about David and know that God was looking for a man after his own heart, that doesn't mean he was looking for somebody that was sinless or somebody that was perfect. We know that David, though described as a man after God's own heart, was far from perfect. What we're looking at is David's trust in God. Now, one of the things that David is noted for in our Romans study is that he had made the remark, blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Now, we saw that in Romans chapter 4 in our Romans study, which was, what, a month or two ago, beginning in about verse 6. And we see that quotation coming from Psalms chapter 32, verses 1 and 2. Blessed is the man whose transgression is forgiven. Who would know better than that than David? Now, you'll also remember that as David wrote, Darrell, question, comment?
No, I'm sorry.
You also note as David wrote in Psalms chapter 51, he said, my sin is ever before me. Just simply because a man can be reckoned as righteous because his sin is forgiven doesn't mean there are no consequences attached to his sin. And we're really going to emphasize that in the life of David. David's life proved to be miserable in many respects because of the sin that he had committed, particularly his sin with Bathsheba. And we'll talk more about that next time. But for next time, please begin reading 2 Samuel. And we'll get into that more next time.